Content warning. This episode contains references to rape, violence, and murder. Please call or visit the hotlines included in the description if you need help.
I Murder!
Hi everyone, welcome to I Murder, the podcast where Gen Z talks true crime. I'm your host, Jocelyn, and although we didn't invite a guest today, I definitely wait until the end of this episode to hear our new segment, which involves you, our listeners. Now, I do have a very special episode for you today. You know, you've heard of Bonnie and Clyde, you've heard of the Ken and Barbie killers, but have you heard of Nebraska's most notorious murder couple, Charles Starkweather and Carol Ann Fugate? It all began on November 30, 1957. It was a chilly Saturday in Lincoln, Nebraska, and 19-year-old Charles Starkweather brought it upon himself to give his 14-year-old girlfriend, Carol Fugate, a gift, which is something he typically did. So he went off to his local gas station and found the perfect gift for her, a stuffed toy dog. However, there was one issue. Charles didn't have enough money to pay for the toy. Nevertheless, he was determined. He wanted this stuffed animal for Carol, so he goes up to the gas station attendant and asks if he can pay for the toy in credit. Robert Colvert, the gas station attendant, refused, and of course, this was really upsetting for Charles. So the two quarreled for a bit, leaving Starkweather no choice but to leave enraged. He fixates on the infuriating situation all day, so much so that it doesn't even let him sleep that night. At 3 a.m., Charles rolls out of bed, grabs his 12-gauge shotgun, and heads back to the gas station. Now, his actions get a little messy here, so just try to keep up. Starkweather enters the station, leaving the shotgun in his car. He buys a pack of cigarettes from the same attendant from earlier, Robert, and leaves. He drives down the road, possibly letting his anger boil some more, before U-turning back to the gas station. He does the same thing. He leaves his gun in the car, walks in the gas station, buys a pack of gum, and he leaves. Except this time, he parks his car a distance away, ties a red bandana over his face, and returns to the station, gun in hand. Charles points the gun directly at Colvert. He steals money from the register and forces Robert to walk back to his car. Gun in hand, Starkweather drives him to a secluded area outside of Lincoln, and when they arrive, he forces Robert out of the car. At this point, Robert isn't going down without a fight. He launches at Charles, trying to get a hold of the shotgun, but mid-fight, a gunshot suddenly blares. Colvert is on the ground, kneecaps severely injured by the gunshot. And Charles doesn't back down. He raises the gun, aiming directly at Robert's head, and with one gunshot, he kills him. And I think it's important to note that not only was Robert the first victim of Charles Starkweather's killing spree, but he was also a soon-to-be father to a beautiful daughter. Charles Starkweather was born on November 24th, 1938, the third of his seven siblings, which is a lot, trust me. And my mom has 11 siblings, so I can tell. He grew up in a respectable family, like both of his parents always did their best to provide for their growing family. And, you know, from the outside looking in, he led a pretty good life. You know, his parents were mild-mannered, they were hardworking. You know, he always had a roof over his head and food on his plate. But once you take a closer look, specifically in his school life, it becomes clear how he was formed to be the monster he was. Starkweather was born with genuvium, a birth defect which caused his legs to be bowed, misshapen. Some people even call it pigeon feet. He also suffered from a speech impediment and severe myopia, which impaired his vision for the majority of his life. All these things caused Charles to be teased relentlessly by his classmates. They accused him of being a slow learner and never applying himself. It was after some time, though, that Charles found his so-called calling. He was excellent in gym, especially because he used his newfound physicality as kind of like an outlet for all of the rage he had built as a result of his bullying. Essentially, he used this as an opportunity to fight his bullies in class. However, his anger grew so much that it began festering outside of gym class. One of his high school friends said, quote, "He could be the kindest person you've ever seen. He'd do anything for you if he liked you. He was a hell of a lot of fun to be around too. Everything was just one big joke to him. But he had this other side. He could be mean as hell, cruel. If he saw some poor guy on the street who was bigger than he was, better looking or better dressed, he'd try to take the poor bastard down to his size." End quote. So now he's just pushing his bullies around. He's picking on completely innocent people. And I mean, like, it just sucks because when you take a step back and analyze his life, you can see how his anger began and how it formed into this animalistic fury. You know, because of this, Charles developed a severe inferiority complex. He believed that everything he did was wrong and couldn't see himself as anything more than a failure. He was miserable. And it makes me question, like, had there not been this persistent bullying, would he have ever hurt innocent people? Like, it's one thing to fight against your bullies, but it's an entirely different situation when you become the bully. And in this case, we're not just talking about bullying. We're talking about something so much bigger than that. Now let's talk about Starkweather's relationship with Carol Fugate. They met in 1956, right after Charles dropped out of high school on a night out, through one of his friends who had been dating Barbara Fugate, who was Carol's older sister. Carol was, as we mentioned, and get ready for this, 13 years old, which is ridiculous to me. Mind you, he was 19 at the time. When I was 13, I thought Harry Styles would fall in love with me if I read a book at his concert. Like, I can't fathom the idea of having dated someone who was nearly 20 years old. And, you know, though Charles was 5 years older than her, I think the reason why she was so transfixed by him was because of his bad boy aesthetic. You know, at the time, James Dean was the it boy. He was the Timothy Chalamet of his time. And leave it to who else but Charles Starkweather to have a deep-rooted fixation on Dean. He adopted literally everything he did. Everything he wore, everything he said, even his mannerisms. I actually posted some of the pictures of Charles on our Instagram at iMurderPodcast. And there you can kind of like see how weird and eerie the similarities are between him and James Dean. So, of course, this hooked Carol in. Soon enough, the two were an inseparable pair. Starkweather chose to work at a Western Union newspaper warehouse simply because it was near Whittier Junior High School in Lincoln, where Carol was a student. Yeah, you heard that right. Junior high school. Like, she was fully in middle school during this entire thing, which, sorry, I still can't get over that. So he would visit her every single day after school. And it was around this time that things started going south for him. He lost his job for being claimed as the dumbest man in the warehouse. His dad kicked him out of his house after having crashed his 1949 Ford. His views on life started changing too. You know, he started following the philosophy that, quote, "dead people are all on the same level," end quote, which, to be honest, took me like 10 entire minutes to understand. So, like, I really need to grow to grip. It basically means that he carries a nihilistic view of the world, so he basically thinks that life is meaningless, void of purpose, which is pretty dark, but I mean, looking at his life, you can kind of see why he thinks that way. Nearly 2 months after his first murder, on January 21st, 1958, Charles went to visit Carol in her home in the Belmont side of Lincoln. She wasn't home, and he was forced to face her unapproving mom and stepdad, who told him to stay away from their daughter. This tipped him over the edge, bringing him to shoot and kill Velda and Marion Bartlett with his shotgun, which is a huge escalation. He didn't stop there, though. He went through the home and, this makes me sick, found their 2-year-old daughter, Betty Jean, and proceeded to strangle and fatally stab her to death. Later on, Charles would report that, quote, "The little girl kept yelling and I told her to shut up and I started to walk again and just turned around and threw the kitchen knife I had at her," end quote. Which I can't even begin to understand how you can not only just kill a toddler, but throw a knife at her. Like, the amount of rage that you have to commit such a horrible crime against such an innocent child, it's just awful. So when Carol eventually comes home, Charles confesses everything he had just done. And you want to take a guess at what she does? She helps him hide the bodies. Yep, they wrapped her stepfather Marion's body in paper and hid him in their chicken house in the back. Her mother and baby sister were buried behind the house. They then prepared sandwiches and ate lunch. The headspace you need to be at to bury your own family's murdered bodies and then have lunch right after. Honestly, I can't even see, like, the human centipede and then eat for another 10 hours, let alone killing your own family. Like, how does that happen? Truly, it honestly makes me wonder if some sort of, like, manipulation was involved. Like, did he fabricate some story to make her, I don't know, side with him? Or did she possess these psychopathic traits which drove her to become his accomplice? You know, we don't really have a way of knowing for sure, but we're going to get more into that in a bit. So the two stay in the house for a total of 6 days. Carol's extended family stopped by the house 2 times, wondering why the family hadn't been seen by anyone. Fugate turned them away, stating that her and her family had been sick through a note taped to her front door that read, quote, "Stay away, everybody is sick with the flu. Miss Bartlett," unquote. And mind you, this was written really poorly. Flu is spelled F-L-U-E, which I'm not even gonna get into it. I'm not letting that grammar freak side of me come out on this podcast just yet. We just started dating, guys. So now this note didn't sit right with Fugate's grandmother. You know, she knew something was wrong. And actually, she had come by to visit and see what was going on too. And thanks to her instincts, she contacted the Lincoln local police department. They arrived on January 27th, but the pair had already been long gone. 4 hours earlier, Charles and Carol had gone on a trip to Bennett, Nebraska to stay at a farmhouse belonging to Starkweather's family friend, August Meyer. With the farmhouse located in rural land, they probably knew that it'd be safe to hide out there for a short time. So when they arrived, Charles fatally shot August Meyer in the head. He also killed his dog, which, come on, like, I hate when serial killers do that. The couple heads out in the early evening to go on an abandoned storm shelter in Bennett. On the way there, their car gets caught up in mud and they're forced to abandon their vehicle. This is when two teenagers, Robert Jensen and Carol King, pull over to offer Charles and Carol a ride. And they quickly accepted. You know, they saw this as a new opportunity to continue their killing streak. So after entering the car, Charles quickly points a gun at Jensen's neck and demands money and a ride to the shelter. When they arrive, Starkweather shoots and kills Robert Jensen, the driver. He attempts to rape the other teenager, Carol King, who was 16 at the time. But when he fails, he fatally shoots her too. Their bodies were hidden in the abandoned storm shelter. They steal Jensen's car and head out of Bennett. And as if they weren't stupid enough, they quickly passed by Carol's house to see if her family's body had been discovered yet, which they had, by the way. Police cars were literally swarming the area, and somehow they still weren't caught. Charles had an advantage as a garbage collector. He knew the southeast side of Lincoln like the back of his hand. And with this, they headed to the wealthier area of Lincoln and entered the home of industrialist C. Lauer and Clara Ward. Here's where things start to change a bit. He knocks on their door. Their housekeeper, Lillian Fend, answers the door. He points his gun at her and orders her to lock the family dog in the basement. Clara goes downstairs after hearing the commotion, only to have Charles threaten her if she didn't cooperate. He walked in the house and ordered her to make waffles and coffee for Carol. And you can totally tell how much he enjoyed the superiority and performance of it all. Clara then goes upstairs to change her shoes, but after she took too long, Charles follows her tracks and is greeted by the end of her own gun. She shoots him, but misses. He immediately throws a knife at her, striking her straight in the back. Charles binds and gags Clara and her housekeeper, Lillian Fenn, before violently stabbing them to death. At around 5:30 p.m. that day, Clara's husband, Lauer, arrives home. Starkweather had been patiently waiting for his arrival in the hallway, shotgun in hand, and as soon as the door swung open, Charles shot him in the head and neck before continuing to stab him in the back. After the murders, Charles sits down and writes a lame attempt to excuse all of the crimes. He poorly writes in a note, quote, "I and Carol are sorry for what has happened, because I have hurt everybody because of it, and so has Carol. But I am saying one thing, everybody than Kane out there was lucky they're not dead, even Carol's sister," end quote. Which I understand is probably difficult to comprehend anything he said, but we will have this written out on our Instagram, so you can kind of like get a visual of what he was attempting to say. So he and Carol steal some of the ward's expensive jewelry and their black 1956 Packard car before heading out west of Lincoln towards Wyoming. Their bodies were later found by Ward's cousin after he was concerned that Ward hadn't shown up to work yet. Remember, all these murders occurred in the span of a few hours, which I know it's hard to imagine, but they were going at it. This was a spree. This caused a huge uproar within Lancaster County. Law enforcement agencies spread out in nearly every corner of the area, searching house to house for the fleeing criminal couple. Lincoln was gripped with so much terror that Sheriff Merle Carnop had no choice but to call for a posse of 100 men equipped with deer guns, shotguns, and pistols. Mind you, this is only for like two people, but you can tell by the severity of all the crimes, this was necessary. You know, Nebraska's National Guards were on duty. Businesses sent their employees to hide in nearby hotels. Parents kept their children indoors, even going to the extent of taking them out of school. Over 1,200 law enforcement officers were on hand, searching for Charles Starkweather and Carol Fugate. Because everyone was keeping their eyes peeled for the black Packard that the couple was driving, they were forced to abandon the vehicle. Reaching Douglas, Wyoming, they found 37-year-old Merle Collison sleeping in his new Buick on the side of Highway 87. They wake him up. Merle attempts to drive the car away, but the engine fails. A nearby motorist, Joy Sprinkle, which, sorry, side note, can I just say that's like the coolest name ever, Joe Sprinkle. His parents, I'd give them a high five if I could. So Joe Sprinkle sees this from afar and he stops by to offer some help. You know, he probably thinks like, okay, there's this dude on the side of the highway. He's clearly having car troubles. Let me go and, you know, offer some of my assistance. So while the motorist is pulling over, Charles shoots Merle a total of 9 times. Starkweather then threatens Joe, shoving the rifle at him. He misses his shot and they begin to wrestle for the gun. It's a matter of time before someone else approaches the scene. To Starkweather's surprise and ultimate defeat, it's Sheriff William Romer. Sprinkle is able to get away from Starkweather, and Carol follows suit, running away from Charles and towards the deputy, screaming. Charles hopped into Sprinkle's vehicle and is on the run. He speeds up to over 100 miles per hour, but is eventually taken down when a police rifle bullet shatters his car's windshield. And the only reason why he stopped was because he thought he had been shot and was bleeding to death. And that really just comes to show, like, he had no remorse for any of his crimes. Like, he didn't turn himself in. He didn't stop at all in behalf of, like, all of the horrible things he had done. He only stopped because he thought he was hurt, which is just so aggravating. And so because of this, both Charles Starkweather and Carol Fugate were caught, bringing their violent killing spree to an end. When the couple was first caught, they didn't display much remorse, that's kind of like how I mentioned. Carol simply cried for her mother until a doctor gave her a sedative. Charles even smiled for the reporter's cameras while he admitted his guilt for the killing spree and the murder of the gas station attendant 2 months prior. Now, you must be thinking, well, Charles admitted to his guilt. Did Carol do that too? To put it straight, no, she didn't. Starkweather initially covered for her, stating that he had held her captive and forced her to take part of all the crimes. And some believe that after learning that she had refused to take any responsibility for the crimes, Charles quickly turned on her during her trial and claimed that she had shared the guilt. Others believe that he was promised not to get the death penalty if he put some of the blame on her. So we really don't know. We just know that he changed his story last minute and put the blame on her too. Both Charles and Carol were tried as adults and faced charges of first-degree murder. At Starkweather's trial on May 5, 1958, his attorneys claimed that he was not guilty by reason of insanity. But believe it or not, Charles went against his own plea. Like, he was really struggling to, you know, cooperate with his lawyers because he believed that the stigma of insanity was worse than the stigma of being a cold-blooded murderer. He was finally charged with first-degree murder and faced the death penalty through the electric chair. Now, the prosecutors only had one shot at landing the death penalty for Charles in this case. They had to choose the most shocking one in order to stir the jury's anger. So they went with the murder of Robert Jensen, which, if you recall, is the teenager who had offered the couple a ride with his girlfriend. With 24 hours of deliberation, the jury made its decision. Charles Starkweather was found guilty on both counts and specifically requested the death penalty. That request was accepted on June 25th when Charles Starkweather died through the electric chair. On October 27, 1958, Carol swore her innocence at her trial. She testified how Charles had forced her to follow him along his killing spree while he threatened to kill her family, meaning that, according to her, she was completely unaware that her family was dead the entire time of the killing spree. And the judge actually didn't believe her story. He claimed that if she had been held hostage, she had multiple opportunities to escape, yet she hadn't taken them. She had also admitted to being present in all of the Nebraska murders, including her family's. So she kind of threw herself under the bus there. Way to go, Carol. On November 25th, after 10 hours of deliberation, the jury found her guilty on first-degree murder. Because she was only 14 at the time, she received a life sentence instead of facing the death penalty. And like, I already mentioned this before, but it's insane how she was 14 years old and facing life in prison. Like, when I was 14, I just keep like looking back to like how old I was. You know, when I was 14, all I cared about was covering up my acne and biology homework. You know, I can't imagine what kind of mental state you need to be at to participate in a killing spree at such a young age. So Carol Fugate served her sentence until she was released on June of 1976. So she served for a total of 17 and a half years in prison. Carol graduated high school in prison and fulfilled all the requirements to become a nurse, but she could never find a solid job with her degree when she was released from prison because of her record. And when she was released, she got married to Frederick Clare, who passed away during a car accident years later. She hasn't really spoken out about the murders except for in 1996 when she was interviewed by a local Lincoln radio station. And during this interview, Carol garnered a lot of sympathy from listeners. She even broke down in tears at one point when one of the callers who had known Carol before the murders stated that she had always known that she was innocent. Now, we don't really know for a fact if she was innocent or not. It's difficult to say just because she was so young at the time and possibly terrified in the spot that she was. but she was still present during the murders, and who knows, she might have killed one of the victims or multiple of the victims. At the end of the day, this isn't about the serial killers. This is about the victims. Like, it doesn't matter how young or dumb or inexperienced you were. These people had their lives taken away. And I would say that Carol earned that punishment by serving her years in prison. There are so many sides to this story, so many unreliable narrators, and it becomes difficult to know which side to trust. But I would love to know your guys' thoughts. Like, do you think that Carol was guilty at all? Do you think she deserved to serve time in prison? Or do you think she deserved to serve more time? You know, like, was she a victim of a toxic relationship? And could this have pushed her into participating in this killing spree? You guys can always leave your theories and your thoughts in our Instagram comment sections at iMurderPodcast. I literally read every single comment, and you guys, like, usually at 3 a.m. I'm just, like, scrolling on my phone through your comments and, like, your reviews, because I don't have a regular sleeping schedule, as people usually don't at my age. So anyway, I just love to read your thoughts. This doesn't mark the end of the episode, though. Earlier, I did promise you guys a new special segment at the end of this episode. And as you know by now, our show's mantra is, you can't be a hottie if you're a dead body. So that kind of gave us the idea to share your I survived stories. We want to hear about how y'all ran away from a creep at your local gas station, or how your grandma turned down an unknown serial killer at the bar. You can send in your stories at our email at... You can send in your stories to our email, imurderpodcast@gmail.com. That's imurderpodcast@gmail.com. And today I have a pretty interesting story who was sent in by one of our listeners. Her name is...
I am 23 and I live alone, and my parents live about 20 minutes away from me. And on this day, neither one of my parents was home, but my grandpa, who lives with my parents, was. And I just go to the house to visit him. And while I'm there, my mom calls me and she says that his CPAP or BiPAP machine, which is this machine that he needs to use to sleep because he has COPD, so his lungs, like, won't work by themselves, especially, like, at night. He needs that machine to help him keep his oxygen levels, like, normal. She's telling me that his machine is broken, and to see if I can get a hold of some sort of technician, and she sends me the number to see if I can figure that out. So the way that it works, like, with these companies is that since it's technically, like, an emergency service, like, he can't go to sleep without it. And it was already, like, I want to say it was, like, 2 o'clock or whatever. We wanted to get it sorted out before he would have to sleep so that he didn't, like, have to stay awake or like, sleep sitting up or whatever. So I call the number, and then they end up matching you. Like, you call, like, the main company, and then the main company matches you to a technician in your area, and that technician reaches out to you, like individually. So I get a call back, like, after I call the number from this technician that they matched me to, and it's this guy on the phone. Sounds like an older man, and he was very nice. He basically just told me that he was with another client and that he would come to come help me afterwards. He had me, like, mess around with the machine and try to, like, give me some instructions beforehand, but I couldn't figure it out. So he just said, okay, well, what's your address, and I'll let you know when, like, when I head over. So I told him my address, and then he texted me. I want to say it was, like, an hour after or so, he texted me, which I thought was a little strange. Like, I don't know, I felt like he should have called, but he just texted me, and he was like, hi, I'm on my way. And I said, okay. So he shows up at the house, and he doesn't speak any Spanish, and my grandpa doesn't speak any English, so they couldn't communicate. So the entire time that this man is there, I want to say it was, like, 20 or 30 minutes, I was the one having to make conversation with him, just because I just felt like it was weird to just leave him alone in the room trying to fix the machine. So I just, like, stood there and, like, spoke with him as he fixed it. And the guy was, I want to say he was, like, over 55. Like, he had, like, gray hair. He was very nice, like I said, like, very respectful. And he started talking to me about his boss and how his boss was, like, younger than him. And I feel like that was what led to, like, the weird question. But he asked me, like, how old I was. Like, stuff like that. Like, I was definitely, like, overthinking everything. I was like, oh, he texted me instead of called. That's a little strange. Oh, he asked me, like, how old I was. That's a little strange. When in reality, he probably, like, didn't mean it with, like, weird intentions. So, long story short, basically, he fixes the machine and then he leaves. And, like I said, I don't live at my house anymore, so I had to go back to my apartment, and this was in the evening, like, probably, it was already, like, nighttime. And so, when I get to my apartment, within, like, 10 minutes of me being back at the apartment, I get a text message from the technician, and he says, hey, and he uses my first name, and he says, are you still at your grandpa's house? And I'm not joking, like, in that moment, I thought that he had followed me to my apartment, and he was going to murder me. Like, there was no other thought in my brain. I was like, there is no reason that this man is texting me right now other than to tell me, like, hey, I followed you. I'm going to rape you and kill you. It literally just says, like, hey, are you at your grandpa's house? And the reason it freaked me out is because I don't remember ever telling him that I didn't live with my grandpa. I mean, I guess he assumed, I don't know if he assumed because I had told him my age, but, like, it's normal for people who are 23 to live with their parents. So I don't know, maybe I forgot that I told him. I hope it was that, but I just thought it was weird. And when he told me, when he said those things, I had just gotten back to the apartment. So it felt like everything in my mind, like, pieced all the horrible things that could happen or why he was asking me this. And I genuinely just, like, freaked out. Like, my heart dropped, and I, like, my door locks automatically, like, from the outside. So, but I, like, went and, like, checked it. And I really wished in that moment that I had those, like, locks from Home Depot that close the door, like, extra. Like, there's, like, an extra hinge or whatever that you can put on the door. Like, I really wanted one in that minute. I thought about putting my chair, like, against the doorknob, but I didn't know, like, how to properly do that. But I'm not joking, like, I thought of all these things, and I said, like, I'm going to die. So I called my mom, and my mom is, like, as psychotic as I am, and she starts panicking, and she's like, oh my god, like, this man, she's like, why is he following you? Like he's totally following you. Like, this is, like, this man is out to kill you. And then I'm like, okay, well, what do I do? And she says, well, hang on a second. And I ended up, like, what she's saying, like, hang on a second. I, like, decided to text my brother. And my brother's like, hey, dude, like, calm down. He probably just needs something because he worked, like, he did some work for you. And so I'm like, well, what should I do? Should I just text him back and be like, no, what do you need? And he said, yeah, just do that. And so I ended up texting the guy back as I'm having, like, a literal panic attack. And, the guy just texted me back, like, it took a while, but he texted me back eventually, like, 30 minutes later, and he said, oh, I just need a picture of the serial number to put it in my system. And I was like, oh, okay. And you see what I mean? Like, it's kind of anticlimactic, but I feel like if you tell it in a certain way, like, then maybe it won't sound as horrible. And also, just, like, a little side note, the reason that my mom freaked out when I told her is because she thought that the technician inside of my building who had just fixed something in my apartment, like, the day before, and she knew about it, she thought that technician somehow got my number, like, inside the building and had asked me if I was in my apartment or not. And that would have been super creepy. Like, that would have actually freaked me out because the technician in my building is, like, that man is, like, 6'2" and could definitely, like, murder me. So that's why she was freaking out, because she thought it was him, not, like, my grandpa's technician. So, yeah, that's my story of the time that I didn't almost get kidnapped, but I thought that I was actually going to get kidnapped.
And that concludes the second episode of I Murder. You guys, I am so grateful for each and every one of you listeners. Like last week when we posted our first episode, I did not think this show would be getting as much attention as it has. I mean, we got on the trending charts for Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Like, I think we got up to even number 21 on the Spotify podcast trending charts, which is absolutely insane. But of course, that wouldn't be possible without you guys. And I do encourage you guys to leave a rate and review on our Apple Podcast, just because that does kind of like help us get a little bit more attention so more people could listen in on the show. But also it helps me kind of like get a feeling as to like what you guys want to see on the show, what you guys think of it, any like suggestions or critiques. Like, that's always very helpful. Do follow our Instagram at iMurderPodcast. That's where we post all of the updates to our show. We kind of give clues every week as to like what the new case of the week is going to be. And we also like do mini games on our story so you guys can participate and have fun throughout the day and stuff like that. Also send in your I Survive stories to our email, imurderpodcast@gmail.com. I do want to hear some of your stories so you guys can be featured on our guest list episodes. And as always, you can't be a hottie if you're a dead body. Thank you for listening. I'm gonna send all of you cookies personally to your door, I swear. Okay, bye. This episode was written, produced, edited, and hosted by Jocelyn Martinez. Music by Kaylee Fermin.